طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. Today we focus on the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Palestine, Francesca Albanese, in a conversation with Laura Friedman, President of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. The Special Rapporteur is an independent expert appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council to follow and report on the human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory. The task of the Special Rapporteur is to assess the human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, report publicly about it, and work with governments, civil society, and others to foster international cooperation. The Special Rapporteur undertakes the regular visit or missions to the occupied Palestinian territory and reports annually to the Human Rights Council. The mandate of the Special Rapporteur derives from the 1993 resolution from the Committee of Human Rights. The mandate calls on the Special Rapporteur to investigate Israel's violations of the principles and bases of international law, international humanitarian law, and the Geneva Convention relative to the protection of civilian persons in time of war in the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel, and to report conclusions and recommendations to the Commission on Human Rights. Francesca Albanese was appointed the Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967 by the Human Rights Council at its 49th session in March 2022. Ms. Albanese is an affiliate scholar at the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University. She has widely published on the legal situation in Israel and the State of Palestine and regularly teaches and lectures on international law and forced displacement at universities in Europe and the Arab region. Ms. Albanese has also worked as a human rights expert for the United Nations, including the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and the UN Relief and Work Agency for Palestine Refugees. The title of this conversation with Francesca Albanese is A War Crime in the Making: Israel's Ethnic Cleansing in the South Hebron Hills. It begins with Friedman framing the discussion.
But I want to really just get right into it today. I'm going to offer just a quick little bit of context and explain why we're talking today. So there is a lot going on these days, as always, with respect to the situation of human rights in the occupied territories. And here we're talking about actions of the Israeli government, officials of the Israeli government, and the armed forces. And let's be clear, these include a lot of things that are important. We have had, since this new government came into place, we've had Palestinians killed almost every day, including a child yesterday. We are having the targeting of the mere raising and holding of the Palestinian flag. We have challenges to the status quo on the Temple Mount Haram al-Sharif. We have continued and expanded demolitions of Palestinian property and new settlement plans. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. Hanging over all of these actions and plans is a very specific threat that a lot of people have been worrying about and watching for a long time. And here we have, we're talking about plans and really well-advanced plans. They advanced under the previous governments. to forcibly eject approximately, I believe it's 1,200 Palestinians from their homes in an area of the southern West Bank known as Musafariyata. And folks who follow the podcast, we've done lots of podcasts over the past couple of years with activists from Musafariyata. I'll put links to all of that in the notes as well. So these plans, and this has been, I think, gotten some social media attention and some news. These plans have been accompanied by years of violent attacks carried out by Israeli settlers, attacks that the previous government demonstrated little interest in preventing or punishing. And we have videos, many videos that document the IDF actively enabling these attacks by doing nothing, standing around, or even actively facilitating these attacks by what they did on the ground. And all of this has been accompanied by a ratcheting up of pressure and punitive actions against Palestinian residents of Musafariyata who have sought to resist nonviolently and who've sought to bring the story of what is happening to them and their families to the world. So I'll put a lot of links in the notes that'll accompany this podcast to resources on Musafariyata and the activists and all of that. But so I wanted to talk to you, Francesca. Musafariyata is by no means the first or the only area in the West Bank from which Israel has worked to remove Palestinian residents since 67. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, international human rights experts have paid special attention to Musafariyata because what Israel is seeking to do there, in effect, clearing out all Palestinians from a huge area of land in order to use that land for Israel's own purposes. This is in the occupied West Bank. In the eyes of legal experts, it has been said that this qualifies unequivocally as an act of ethnic cleansing and a war crime. And that's your area of expertise. So I want to dive into the question of what it means, what ethnic cleansing means, why is this a war crime, and all the related questions to that. So if you're okay with that, before we jump in, I know that probably not everyone who's listening today knows about you and about your mandate and your position. So I want to just ask you to quickly describe who you are at the UN, what you're doing, and what's the mandate of your work.
Yeah, thank you, Lara, and I'm happy to greet all your all the participants. As a special rapporteur, a role that I have since May 2022, I am an independent expert who's been appointed by the Human Rights Council for a term of 6 years to report to the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly on an yearly basis on the human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territories as of 1967, namely West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. And I was appointed on my capacity as a legal expert who has devoted quite a few years to the question of Israel, Palestine, Palestinian refugees, and the human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory. I serve as voluntarily, and on this is why, aside of it, I also continue to work as in a number of universities teaching forced displacement and on migration and forced displacement in the Arab region with an organization called ART. So my main responsibility as a special rapporteur is to report to the General Assembly and the Human Rights Council on issues that are fundamental to me. As you might have noticed, I've decided to keep the focus thematic, and this is why my first report was about the right of self-determination, because it's just very fundamental and still very unachieved for the Palestinian people in the occupied Palestinian territory. And I so want to continue to focus on specific themes, as well as I'm trying to interpret this mandate creatively, trying to provoke debate and dialogue, because the question of the human rights situation in the OPT, it's either largely obscured or largely misunderstood.
Absolutely. And I will include a link to your first report for people who want to read it. It is superb and very disturbing, but really important. As you said, your focus academically, and you've written about this, like you have a book on refugees, you've written about displacement. So let's dig into the Musafariyata story. This comes up in the news a lot, but there isn't a lot of, I think, in-depth, accessible explanations. So first off, I want to talk about the general. What is a war crime? You know, mm-hmm. not everyone is an expert in international law. Isn't, you know, what is it? What is this supposedly shared system of values and governance on which this war crimes designation even rests? What does it mean?
Yeah, okay. Makes sense to start with the basics, because in fact, many people would be confused by seeing the discussions unfolding around Massafer Yatta's always associated to war crimes. So the designation of war crimes rests primarily on international humanitarian law, which is a body of law governing situations of armed conflict and occupation. So it consists basically of the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Regulations, whose main purpose is to protect and preserve humanitarian values at times of war. So what does it mean in practice? These norms regulate the conduct of hostilities, limiting the means and methods of warfare to what is absolutely necessary to achieve the objectives of the parties to a conflict. And also, and this is very important here, humanitarian law, which regulates what might constitute a war crime, provides protection and humane treatment to persons who do not or no longer participate in hostilities and are of particular importance, like civilians. So while many acts might violate the Hague Regulations and the Geneva Convention, so while many acts might violate the law of war, not every violation constitutes a war crime. A war crime is a serious violation of the laws and customs that apply in armed conflict or during an occupation, and it gives rise to individual criminal responsibility in international law. For example, willful killing, willful causing great suffering or injuries to body or health, torture or inhumane treatment in situation of conflict, depriving prisoners of war or other protected person of access to fair trial, unlawful deportation or transfer, or unlawful confinement. All these constitute war crimes. So there is a specific list of what constitutes war crimes. And already the examples I mentioned, like particularly unlawful deportation of transfer, echo with the reality in Massafer Yatta, which we will have the chance to unpack.
So that's great for a start. And so I guess you didn't use the term ethnic cleansing. So I want to ask you to delve into the term ethnic cleansing, because that's a term that comes up often. It comes up as a general claim of what is going on, but specifically with Massafer Yatta, where you have a plan to remove people. So can you just talk about that term, and if there's a better term for us to be using for this kind of discussion, you know, explain that.
Yeah, definitely. I think the term is correct. But under international law, ethnic cleansing does not constitute a legal category per se, and is not a war crime per se. The closest juridical definition of war crime, of ethnic cleansing, dates back to the tragic events in former Yugoslavia in the 90s, where in 1994, a UN-appointed commission of experts concluded what is ethnic cleansing, what might constitute ethnic cleansing, basically the rendering of an area ethnically homogeneous by using force or intimidation to remove person of a given group from an area. And the experts particularly stressed the removal of the civilian population of another ethnic and religious group by violent and terror-inspiring means from certain geographic areas. So while since then there was never a proper convention or a proper, definition of the crime, there is a list of coercive practices that have been identified as ethnic cleansing. And within the scheme that I said, meaning the idea of remove one part of the population to replace it with another ethnic or religious group, acts like murder, arbitrary arrest and detention, extrajudicial execution, severe injury to civilians, deliberate military attack or threats against civilians, and attacks on civilian structures like hospital, schools, and medical or educational personnel, all might constitute ethnic cleansing. So you see, Lara, in a way, while ethnic cleansing does not constitute a war crime per se, most of the practices authoritatively identified as constituting ethnic cleansing constitute crimes against humanity. And according to the jurisprudence of the International Tribunal on Former Yugoslavia, there are also obvious similarities between ethnic cleansing and genocidal policy. So it's a very serious issue. This is why it's totally correct to use it, but knowing that it's not the crime per se. Sorry.
Understood. So ethnic cleansing more describes the overarching policy, and the policies that implement it, there might be the war crimes embedded in that, particularly in we're talking to it today about displacement. Last general scene setting question. So you talked about criminal liabilities associated with ethnic cleansing or with war crimes. What obligations does international law place on countries of the world to intervene to prevent or punish war crimes in general?
The international community has a huge responsibility to prevent and address, to challenge war crimes. Because first of all, international humanitarian law, which I mentioned, the Geneva Conventions and its protocols make respect and ensuring respect for the provision of IHL an obligation erga omnes, which means that it rests upon each and every member state. It's so important that it can suffer no derogation and no exception. Also, so stopping the war crime is an international responsibility, but also the Rome Statute requires states to cooperate with the International Criminal Court in the investigation and prosecution of war crimes, as well as crimes against humanity, serious crimes. The problem is that there are measures that can be taken. Even the UN Charter lists what remedies can be taken to put an end to a serious illegal act. For example, the UN Security Council has the power to maintain and restore international peace and security, to stop war crimes by using all its measures, including economic, political, diplomatic measures, which includes sanctions toward the responsible states. This is a responsibility, but this is where the problem starts, because politics puts international law in the corner in the case of Palestine.
All right, so hold on to that idea, because we're going to circle back to that in a little while. But now I want to actually talk about what's happening in Misafariyata. And I know you're following this closely. So again, more scene setting than the stuff on the ground. We'll get to that in a second. But what are Israel's legal obligations under international law as the occupying power with respect to the residents of Misafariyata? Setting aside the whole is committing ethnic cleansing right now, assuming that it's trying to do everything exactly right, what are its obligations as the occupier?
Yeah, so Israel's obligations as an occupying power, and assuming that Israel had a legitimate basis to be the occupying power, which, as you know, together with other legal scholars and my and the special rapporteurs who preceded me, I contend. I think that Israel it shouldn't be the occupying power. But this is besides the point now, and we can come back to this. But under humanitarian law, Israel is under an obligation to act in good faith and take all the measures in its power to ensure public order and safety, and respect the laws enforced in the country. It is to, in a way, it has administrative power power to maintain public order and safety, first and foremost, in the interest of the occupied population. And the expulsion of Massafer Yatta residents and destruction of the individual and collective properties, the seizure of land, constitute prima facie war crime, precisely because of that, because Israel is acting violently against its obligation to ensure public order and safety under international law. In fact, it's turning its administrative powers into a tool for conquest, basically.
And for folks who aren't familiar with the history of the land in question, I'll put links into the notes as well on this. But it should, I think, be recognized here. Israel's claim to the land in Massafer Yatta derives from having declared it a firing zone many, many years ago. And then over the years, it has allowed settlements to grow in the area. And this is now just straight up, you know, we're going to take this land for ourselves and declaring Palestinian presence on the area illegitimate based on the fact that Israel declared it a firing zone on top of them at some point. And a lot of work has been done on that. I'll also put a link to a document that was found by an Israeli NGO that does freedom of information requests and looks at archives. And it's a document from the original era of Ariel Sharon when, I think he was then the minister of housing construction, or defense minister, I forget which, where he actually, it was explicit that the idea of declaring the firing zone was to depopulate the area of Palestinians. That's in writing. So I want to ask another question here, which is, because I think for a lot of people listening to this and coming into this who aren't familiar, I mean, since 1967, Israel has done a lot of arguably terrible and illegal under international law things across the whole of the West Bank, and even in 48 and inside the Green Line. And you know, we've had Palestinians lose their homes, we've had them lose their ID cards and their residency rights. We've had, you know, we've lots of land has been taken. I think it's more than 50% of the West Bank. So why does what is happening today in Massafer Yatta, the threatened forced removal of Palestinians from the entire area, why does that stand out compared to other actions that Israel has taken against Palestinians since 1967 or even 1948?
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it stands out, no doubt, although it's not an isolated incident. But let me elaborate. So first of all, I would like to say that Massafer Yatta has featured prominently in my work as a special rapporteur since the very first day of my mandate, because it was on the 4th of May, the decision of the Israeli High Court of Justice to confirm the quote-unquote eviction orders that Israel has issued for the almost 1,200 Palestinians inhabitants of Massafer Yatta.
If I could just add, so this goes back to the question of Israeli courts. For folks who are not following this, the eviction of Palestinians from the area, the ejection of Palestinians from their homes and land has been challenged now in Israeli courts for I think almost two decades.
Yes.
That came to a head under the last government when the Supreme Court pretty much ruled authoritatively that it didn't matter what the intent was behind the closed military zone, and it didn't matter pretty much anything the Palestinians could produce. The fact was that they were going to give it a legal stamp. Which I think for people who are listening to the debate around the efforts to change Israel's legal system right now, the justice system, and you see Palestinians saying that justice system has not been particularly good at rendering justice, this is the kind of example of what I think a lot of us would say is the Israeli court system essentially becoming a factory for generating legal opinions that make legal whatever Israel wants to do in the West Bank. So that's the basis of that, the framing that people need to understand for that legal decision last May. So go ahead, sorry.
No problem. So probably we should start really more granular for those who are not familiar with the area. Massafer Yatta is a fairly underdeveloped area of 36 square kilometers comprising 12 Palestinian villages south of Hebron, which is in the south of occupied West Bank. It's occupied under international law. There is also a decision, an advisory opinion of the ICJ on top of analysis of authoritative scholars and the UN, everyone. There is no dispute, because I know that in Israel, many refer to the occupied Palestinian territory as disputed land. There is nothing disputed. This is occupied. So, in this area, Israel should, if it was a legitimate, good faith occupier, should just have exercise administrative powers, which it does not. Now, under the Oslo Accords, Israel controls, Masafriyat is part of Area C. So the area where Israel has total civic and security control. But this doesn't give Israel the right to violate every right and freedom of the population under occupation. In fact, what you were saying is correct. What has happened is that I was talking right today, by the way, let me do this detour. Right today, I was having a virtual tour in Masafriyat, completely unrelated from this interview. And the residents were taking me through the territory. One of them was stopped and detained for 40 minutes. So for 40 minutes, I said, let me be with you. I will stay on the line. So I saw everything that happened. And it was regular harassment. Just the person was fined because riding a car which had no permit on a road which is unauthorized, because Israel doesn't authorize the construction of roads for the Palestinians. It's very complicated. And also, the abusive manners could not be missed, even if I was just on a Zoom. However, they were telling me that until the 70s, the residents of Masafriyat, I've never seen any Israelis. I mean, any Israeli soldiers or Israeli vehicles. What they saw was Israeli construction starting on the hills. So the settlements started in the 70s, and then the settlements expansion needed roads, infrastructure. And this is why the land of Masafriyat, which is not of prime interest back in the late 60s, because for settlement constructions, because it's a lowland. While we know that the settlements have been establishment on the hilltops. But that piece of land was necessary because it was needed for the development of the settlements for grazing purposes, for agriculture, to connect the settlements. And so that land was to be taken. It was not that easy to expropriate the entire piece of land. So Israel declared the firing zone 1918, about 20 years ago. And immediately the residents took the case to the court. They wanted to have the court repealed, the eviction orders repealed. And there has been a legal battle of 20 years, which has concluded last year, as I was saying, on the 4th of May, when the court, the Israeli High Court, confirmed the eviction orders. And so it exhausted. By this mean, the Palestinians, the residents of Masafriyat, have exhausted all means to oppose the expulsions. I mean, we call it eviction, but it's an expulsion. And this is where the criminal aspect of it comes into play. And on the 4th of January, the Israeli authorities informed the Palestinian authorities of their intention to proceed with the evictions. Of course, already in the past months, after May, there have been destruction of houses, and the people there have been forced to move into caves. There have been destruction and attacks, including through violent means on schools, and this is the reality. So as you can see, yes, it's an isolated case in a way. No, it's not an isolated case. It's a case that stands out because of its volume, because 1,200 people. This is the largest forced displacement in the occupied Palestinian territory since 1967, when 350,000 people were displaced, and after 1948, where the numbers, of course, were much higher. But this is the reality. How can it be? How can Israel displace 1,200 people to create a firing zone? A firing zone, which is an area for the military to be trained. It's inhumane, it's unconscionable, it makes no sense whatsoever. And it's also bringing a lot of despair and destruction.
Thanks. And I found myself thinking as you're talking about this, I think it's worth pointing out for folks who are watching and listening this, the Israeli government considers the presence of Palestinians in the area to be illegal. And the argument is they're simply implementing the law. I think it's important to note that the Israeli government has performed feats of legal, it's beyond miracles, in order to ensure that settlers who go in and settle in violation of Israeli law on land that even Israel recognizes belongs to private Palestinian owners. Israel has basically gone to the extent of literally destroying the rule of law, even in their own eyes, in order to make sure that the lives of settlers are not inconvenienced. The idea being, and this is the idea behind what's called the regulation law, which is one of the fact that the Israeli Supreme Court objected to some aspects of this law is one of the reasons why we now have a government that is going to essentially take down the Supreme Court. But that regulation law is based on the idea that the fabric of life and the quality of life of Israeli settlers has to be respected above all else. And there has to be a way to make sure that you don't disturb them because they meant well and they're living where they're living. There's got to be a way to keep them there. On the other hand, Palestinians, that never applies. And Musafer Yatta is just, I think, a glaring example, as we have likely the going ahead with the ripping apart the lives of more than 1,200 Palestinians, men, women, and children, while in parallel, the Israeli government, this new government, is committed to go ahead and find a way to quickly legalize what is illegal settler construction all over the West Bank, because above all else, the rights of those settlers has to be respected. I mean, that's where we are today, and that I think is, you know, it exemplifies what is occupation. There's a lot more to get into. I want to ask you, you referred before to the criminal side of this, of a war crime and legal obligations. What are specifically the legal obligations of the international community, including the US and the EU, in the face of what is happening and what is likely to soon happen in Musafer Yatta? You know, what should and must they be doing if they're following the rules to prevent a war crime in the making? And what kind of tools do they have at their disposal should they want to?
If you don't mind, Lara, I would like to elaborate on a point which is quite significant also in my own work. I agree with you that Musafer Yatta is not an isolated situation and epitomizes what is happening to the entire occupied Palestinian territory through different regimes, because Gaza is always kept aside and seems to be another story, but is not. I want to stress the fact that Israel has no sovereignty over the territory which militarily occupies and keeps under blockade, including Gaza. So while I answer your question of what are the legal obligations, I would like to think of the entire illegal regime that Israel, of domination, and sorry to say, terror that Israel maintains over the OPT should face. Because the UN Charter, as I was saying, affords multiple measures to prevent and address the commission of war crimes. The primary responsibility is vested with the Security Council to maintain peace and security. And I particularly refer to Chapter 7, which includes measures not involved the use of armed force, like the complete or partial interruption of economic relations, communications, diplomatic relations, as well as demonstrations. And as a last resort, military operations. Now, international crimes stem from international norms of a peremptory character that are, as I was saying, absolute and cannot be derogated. So the seriousness of their content translates into erga omnes obligations, which mean a third state's duty to comply with. So the US and European Union, to mention a few, are under the obligation to use these political, economic, and diplomatic measures that the UN Charter referred to, including in the absence of a UN Security Council resolution, because eventually economic diplomatic measures can be taken by any state. In the face of such a prolonged and continuous series of alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity, major army suppliers, the US and the EU, particularly the US, which I recall $3.8 million US dollars budget goes to the Israeli army and exchange.
Billion with a B, 3.8
billion. Did I say million? No, billion, 3.8 billion US dollars go to the Israeli army. And I was saying maintain also a vivid exchange of military trainings. All these should end immediately. And also the trade of arms and systems manufactured by Israel. This is what complying with international law and erga omnes obligations means. You know, and I'll conclude with this, I fear that it will be hard to continue to speak about international law to the Palestinians if even this, even an event absolutely outrageous, like the displacement of 1,200 people, cannot be stopped. And Palestinians today were telling me, we don't want to be left alone. Viv Batim, this is what they were reporting. I think that we cannot ask them to have faith in international law anymore after if these plans go ahead, because the international community is doing everything it can to prove the Palestinian that international law doesn't count, that human rights do not count, and peaceful resistance doesn't lead to anything, especially Masafer Yatta, which is a symbol of peaceful resistance. It's active youth call themselves youth of Sumud, the youth of resilience. Well, the enactment of the expulsions will be a defeat of civic resistance, and in the face of all of us who believe in international law as a way out to the current impasse.
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly important point. And I guess I want to ask you, you know, assuming Israel does go ahead and carry out ethnic cleansing in Masafer Yatta, which at this point feels almost inevitable, what potential avenues do Palestinians and Palestinian rights activists have for accountability, justice, repair, reparations, etc.? I mean, we have pending questions before the ICC and now the ICJ. I mean, can you talk about that? Because that is, yeah. I mean, I think for a lot of us who've watched this over the years, it is hard almost to avoid the conclusion that by either deliberately or just by happenstance, the international and Israeli policies have combined to effectively cut off all avenues for Palestinians to pursue their rights, to pursue justice. And sort of put them in a corner of either you roll over and allow yourself to get kicked in the stomach over and over and over, or you turn to weapons and that's illegitimate and you're terrorists. It seems like everything else is being cut off, including the right to, you know, organize economic boycotts or to pressure the international community via, you know, whatever means would be acceptable for coming from, you know, people supporting Ukraine, for example.
Mm. Yeah, no, I mean, speaking of Ukraine, there is again one thing that comes to my mind, that some states can still go back to a principled stand and implement measures, the measures afforded by the UN Charter, so including economic and diplomatic sanctions as prescribed thereby. And I was thinking, as you're hearing you, that the way, I mean, an illustrative case of how these measures can be taken is precisely the most recent Russia invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. Economic sanctions, divestment from corporate sectors, boycotts of institutions and goods, and to diplomatic communication and opposing to diplomatic relations have been very swift, and including by countries which had very close ties with Russia. So I keep on having faith in the political process. It cannot be completely completely immoral as it is being toward the Palestinians. But meanwhile, in order to have justice, because all the legal avenues have been exhausted inside Israel, and because there is no regional mechanism for them, but the only avenue that really remains is the ICC, the International Criminal Court, which should accelerate proceedings on the situation of Palestine, and the prosecutor should allow the investigation to start in a more visible way, because the eviction of Masa Feryata is the only tip of the iceberg of the plethora, as we have said, of alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity committed against the Palestinian. Many of us believe that an ICC investigation would help address the decade of impunity and send a strong message to the international community that what Israel is doing will no longer be tolerated. And this is also going to, in a way, restate the reputation of the ICC as an international criminal mechanism of last resort, where other means prove to be unwilling or unable, unavailable. Now, one other thing that has not been fully explored, I mean, universal jurisdiction, yes, has been explored and has been hijacked by political maneuvers as well. But I do believe that domestic courts are also important options, particularly because many of those involved in the commission of war crimes and crimes against humanity, particularly those from the colonies, the settlers, have double nationality. And I think that this is an important issue to keep in mind, because probably it's going to be more accessible than what should be the most accessible to the Palestinians, which is the ICC.
Fascinating. The issue of domestic courts has come up often in the Israeli-Palestinian domain. It's come up more often used as a weapon against Palestinians and Palestinian rights activists. It'll be interesting to see if we see a shift in that going forward. I want to sort of pull the camera out and first ask you, and you are obviously deeply engaged across the whole of Palestine. For a lot of people, you see it as fragmented areas with different interests, different concerns. You're looking at the whole of the occupied territories. You know, for a lot of us looking at what's threatened in Masa Feryata, the concern I think is twofold. One, that it will do it and get away with it, and 1,200 people or so will be, you know, just deprived of the most basic rights. And the concern that this is that if Israel is permitted to do this and get away with it without consequence, impunity, as always, it'll be the precursor to further acts of this kind of ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, particularly in Area C, but not only in Area C. Can you talk about whether you share that concern and why you think that matters? And when people should be engaging because it's a war crime on its own. It shouldn't be, if you let this happen, more will happen. But those are not disconnected concerns, right?
No, exactly. I mean, and this is something that has come up in the past. If you can displace a population of 1,200 people, which means the uprooting of 1,200 people, the destruction of the homes where these people have kept everything together under enormous challenges, because whomever has visited Masa Feryata, including myself, has said, oh my God, how do they manage to stay here? Because it's not that, hey, they are really hanging there to preserve the life in paradise. Life is very difficult, Aziz, but these people are resisting because it's their land and it's a sort of a collective effort. So yes, I share the fear that this will prove, I mean, because impunity, granting Israel's impunity for every alleged violation, every alleged war crimes and every alleged crime against humanity, for every violation that has committed, and it's a fully documented reality, probably the best documented scenario of human rights violations and violations of international law at large of modern era, the reality in the OPT. So because all of it has been tolerated, this has emboldened Israel to a point that today, yes, it can displace 1,200 people without even facing serious reprisal. This is the thing. So, of course, it's going to prove that the Palestinians are just subjects under domination and fully disposable. This is what's going to demonstrate.
I find myself thinking as we're having this conversation, you think about how this plays out in the public debate, and I'm anticipating, we spend a lot of time these days focusing on the efforts to redefine anti-Semitism to essentially mean, most importantly, if not exclusively, criticism of Israel. And the argument I'm imagining is going to come up when Musafer Yatta is ethnically cleansed is, well, other people are doing it and they're doing it more. And therefore, if you're focusing on Israel, you're an anti-Semite. So it's the script writes itself, and it's quite extraordinary because 20 years ago, saying, well, other people are doing worse ethnic cleansing than we are would not have been considered a particularly effective argument for defending Israel and its righteousness. But that is where we are today. Yeah. Again, zooming out, we are in an era of surging illiberalism. It almost seems, you know, just trite to even say it, and an era of even greater erosion of a pretense of respect for international laws and legal norms and norms of behavior than we have seen in the past. I want you to talk about, as someone who is steeped in the international legal environment, what you see as the broader impacts of what is happening in the occupied territories in general, and specifically Musafer Yatta, where you have what is effectively viewed as a first world liberal democracy acting thus far with impunity and on the verge of carrying out what is a very specific and well-documented war crime of the kind that lots of countries around the world probably are doing, would be very happy to do, and would see Israel doing it. I'm thinking of someone like Modi and what we're seeing in India, would see it as a wonderful precedent and model for how to ethnically cleanse people and get away with it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I might partially repeat myself, but I think it's important to say that over the past 55 years, the tolerance of Israel's continued non-compliance with international legal obligations has emboldened Israeli impunity and has tarnished the image, the trustworthiness, and the role of international community as a whole. This exceptionalism has undermined, of course, the primacy of international rule of law, and it's been, as you say, a damning lesson for others who know that brute force leads to greater results than compliance with international law, and breach of international law bears no consequences if one is protected by the right friends. As I said to the General Assembly on the day I presented my first report, when human rights are true just for a small number of people, they betray the very promise of universality of human rights, and they prove no more than the rules of a club. And this is what's happening. Israel's behavior is consolidating the international law system that has emerged of the out of the ashes of the World War II as a compromise system, as a system that only favors and protects one part of the world, which, no surprise, it's still Western countries to which Israel is associated. This is what's happening.
Yeah, I was joking with someone, we're increasingly in an era where laws that were framed as protecting the rights of the weak are now used exclusively to protect the privilege of the strong, which is just turning things really very much on their heads. Okay, so we're running out of time, or we've gone way over time. You've been very patient. My last question, I want to circle back to you and your mandate as special rapporteur. And can you talk about what your role is as you see it with respect to Musafir Yatta? And to the extent that you're willing to talk about it, can you talk about what are your plans?
Yeah, on Musafir Yatta, I will continue the work of bilateral mobilization, meaning raise the case in every meeting with authorities I have, and of course keep on documenting and reporting, because my audience eventually is made of states. But I also engage, and this leads me to the second part of your question. I mean, as a rapporteur, as a special rapporteur, I had to ask myself pretty early on what kind of special rapporteur I want to be, because the situation, in fact, last year has been evolving, has been spiraling down pretty fast. So I cannot be the one setting the law, because international law is very clear. It's not about standard setting, and it's not about unveiling the unknown, although I'm also investigating on practices which have remained completely and inexplicably to me underreported, and this will be clear in the second report I'm writing. But I said, I want to be the one which creates a space for discussion and for debate, including other actors. And I've been quite active toward Jewish communities in Israel and abroad. Not very easy, not obvious, but it's happening. And with Palestinian communities in the diaspora, I mean, we need to be many to mobilize and advocate for the report, for the respect of international law in the occupied Palestinian refugees. This is not the job of the special rapporteur, but the special rapporteur can help elevate the discussion and the messages for returning to the primacy of international law. And the report I'm writing right now is about carcerality. So arrest and detention as key to the policy of control that Israel maintains in the occupied Palestinian territory, but also from a geographic perspective. We have this tendency of referring to Gaza as an open-air prison, but in fact, I think that the overall territory under occupation resembles a prison with different regimes of carcerality. And this is what I'm describing.
Excellent. So that gives me a lead in to remind you that I know to tell you that I will be asking you probably to come back and talk about that report when it comes out. For folks who are listening, I also want to remind people, if they haven't seen this in the media, that as rapporteur, Francesca has not been permitted by Israel to travel to the area that she is covering. This is one of the aspects of occupation, that when Israel says there is no occupation and yet, you know, if you want to visit the Palestinians and see things on the ground in Palestine, you are obligated to get permission from Israel to travel. So you mentioned you had done a Zoom visit to Musafir Yatta today. I think it's worth noting that that is because you are not permitted by the Israeli authorities to go there yourself as yet. Maybe that will change. We can all hope that will change.
I will do everything in my power to change it and to challenge it, because it's abnormal. And also the fact that everyone tolerates it as if it was a normal fact of life is not really proper.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's not proper at all. So we're going to have to stop there. You have been so generous with your time, Francesca. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You have been listening to Laura Friedman from the Foundation for Middle East Peace and the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine, discussing Israel's ethnic cleansing taking place in the South Hebron Hills. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, where you can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. You can also stream us live every Friday morning at KKRN.org at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. Please join us again next week when we will talk again.